in publications such as Dialogue, Utah Historical Quarterly, Journal of Mormon History, and Sunstone. She is also coming out, and I don't think it's out yet, is it, Marty, with a book entitled Kidnapped from That Land, The Government Raids on Polygamists of Short Creek, which will be published by the University of Utah Press. She also has various contributions in the works, several of which will be published by the University of Illinois Press in 1994, as well as an entry for the Atlas of Mormonism edited by Don Cannon for Mormon Polygamy, which will be published by Simon and Schuster in 1994, and others. The other panelist is Jeffrey W. Shields, who will speak concerning legal standards of evidence. He is an attorney and a partner with the law firm of Souter, Axel, and Armstrong & Hanson, specializing in securities, bankruptcy, and commercial litigation. Mr. Shields received his law degree from Pepperdine University in 1980, where he was named to the Dean's Honors List and joined the Utah State Bar that same year. He has handled several large complex cases, most recently representing a New York Stock Exchange public company in the Lincoln Savings Charles H. Keating Jr. civil litigation in Arizona. He is a member of the American Bankruptcy Institute, Commercial Law League of Utah, and the Salt Lake County Bar Association. He has served as chair of the Corporate Counsel section of the Utah State Bar and as a trustee of the Utah Opera Company. Today's session concerns the uses of evidence by historians and with some discussion of the legal standards which are utilized in evidence and relating those to historical writing. So Dr. Bradley will begin, then Jeff will discuss those legal standards, and then I will follow up.
I thought I would talk today about, first of all, perhaps some philosophical questions about the whole pursuit of truth in history writing. Where Michael and Jeff come from such a different point of view, they are lawyers and they have legal minds, and I don't think at all like a lawyer. I think more like a historian. But I also think as a Mormon. And one of the things that it seems we are preoccupied with as Mormons is this whole issue of truth. And I think then that places an obligation of those of us who write history about Mormonism that sort of complicates our endeavor. It seems that we are preoccupied with this chase for truth. As children, we are taught to proudly maintain that this is the only true church. We are taught incessantly to tell the truth. When I was a little girl and my father suspected me of wrongdoing, he would say to me, and he would always look me straight in the eyes when he said this, and it would just pierce my heart. He would say, "If you tell the truth, you won't be punished." There was something then, some sort of hierarchy of good and evil, at the top of which truth, telling the truth, coming straight, held prominence. Nevertheless, our historical tradition has ironically not necessarily been about truth-telling. And by that, I do not mean that it has been intentionally dishonest, but it has been oriented toward a different hierarchy of values, certainly different from my father's. And at the top of that hierarchy is preserving the faith of the saints. Therefore, books like the longtime classic Essentials of Church History told faith-promoting stories, leaving out important details. The most current example of this technique, how many of you have seen the movie that's at the Joseph Smith Memorial, the film Legacy? Just a couple of you. Well, you all need to go see it. It is a story that is based loosely on the diary of Mary Rollins Leitner, which is a very beautifully written and very potent account of some of the early episodes of church history. The way it is filmed, this film is really like a Cecil B. DeMille epic film with some breathtaking images, and it just tugs at your heart's strings. In fact, at the showing that I went to, Gordon B. Hinckley introduced it, and he said, "I can tell you that by the end of this film, there will not be a dry eye in this room." And I sat up, and I was just so ready not to be impressed by this film, but there were many very impressive things about it. But I was too familiar with the document that it was based on to feel comfortable with the story it told. Because in my way of looking at it, even though it was a compelling presentation of the myths of our early church, and some of them are stories, but some of them I think have taken on mythic significance. They're larger than life. Even though it's compelling, and these are stories that move many Mormons to tears, I'm not sure that they're true. Let me tell you what I mean. If you use Mary Rollins Leitner's diary as the guide or the measuring stick of the truthfulness of that film, the answer is most certainly no. There is truth, and there is truth, which is what I would like to talk about in a minute. But let me tell you what I mean in the context of this film. The film details the life of a young girl who's called Eliza in the film, but who is really Mary, who as a little girl meets Joseph Smith, and he's the one that gives her what she calls the Gold Bible. She moves with her family to Clay County in Far West, and you see her family build these little houses, and that's really one of my favorite things of the film is this portrayal of their struggles and the buildings that they lived in. Finally, she ends up in Nauvoo, and in Nauvoo, she meets one of the converts of her father who had traveled to England and converted a very handsome, very dashing young stonemason who will, in the film, carve the sunstone for the Nauvoo Temple. And she falls in love with him. And it's a wonderfully moving story, very compelling. But there's just one really important detail that's left out, which in my way of looking at it makes this an untrue story, and that is that she was sealed to Joseph Smith while in Nauvoo. So what we are getting is the sugar coating on the story, or part of the story. And I think we as truth seekers have an obligation to also observe the other side of the moon, to see the other part of the story which was so significant in terms of the story of Nauvoo. That one small detail is of such momentous importance, in my opinion, that it colors the entire narrative. It changes the whole story. It is enough of an exclusion to make the story untrue, a false representation. It fails to address the complexity of the man Joseph Smith, of the interrelationships between the saints, and even this one particular woman's willingness to sacrifice. Let me tell you another example. One of the women that I study is a woman named Zina Diantha Huntington Jacobs Smith Young, and her name itself can give you a sense of the complexity of her story. Zina, as a young girl, was converted with her family, and they moved to Kirtland, they moved to Missouri, and they moved to Nauvoo, and they were with the core of Mormons, the very most faithful. They were part of the elite. And in Nauvoo, at the age of 18, she starts to be courted by a young man named Henry Bailey Jacobs. And her accounts of that time period describe that courtship as something really quite lovely. He was dashing, he was a violin player, he moved her spirit. He moved her in a way that she decided that this would be the person she would marry. Her courtship with Henry was complicated by the fact that during that time period in Nauvoo, Joseph approached her with the news that he had been visited by an angel of the Lord and instructed that she would become one of his spiritual wives. And she describes that conversation as being very difficult, shaking her to her soul, and she prayed and prayed and prayed for deliverance. And she believed that she had essentially put Joseph off, and she married Henry. Well, 6 months later, after she had become impregnated with Henry's child, Joseph sent her brother Dimmock to Zina again with a message, this time saying that the angel had a drawn sword. And Zina was one of those most faithful saints who believed that if the prophet of the Lord told her to do something, that she must find a way to reconcile it and to find a way to do it. And so she became married to Joseph. During this time period in Nauvoo, while she's married to Henry Bailey Jacobs, Joseph sends Henry on 8 different missions. You know, these are her first years of marriage, and she is poverty-stricken, as so many of the saints in Nauvoo were. And she had to struggle to stay on her feet. She opened little schools, and, you know, she had to depend on her father and her sister and her brother for sustenance. But she's faithful throughout it. And she writes in her diary of how much she misses Henry. Every time he leaves, she writes in her journal how much she misses him. And she prays, in this journal. You know, she writes to God in the journal. She prays for comfort not just because he's gone and she doesn't have enough food on the table, but so that her heart will rest, because she misses this man, because she loves him. The contemporary account of these events, then, is that this relationship between Henry and Zina is tender and dear and loving. After Joseph Smith is martyred, a year later, many of the apostles take Joseph's sealed wives, his spiritual wives, as their temporal wives. And in the process of marrying Zina, Jacobs, and I'll leave out the rest of the names, Brigham Young essentially dissolves, without any legal ceremony, the marriage between Zina and Henry. Sends Henry off on a mission so he can deal with his anguish in London. But this is a very difficult, very painful, very complex episode. And Zina becomes part of Brigham Young's plural family in winter quarters, and she does not become his wife, in fact, until 2 years later in the Great Basin. And even that day, when she records that very interesting evening when Brigham Young first visited her bed and this relationship changes, she writes of that event as one of the phrases that is so particularly moving is she says that floods of tears flowed through my eyes. Now, Zina Diantha Young, at that point, then goes off to become a leader of Mormon women. And she, in her later life, begins recounting the story of these days in Nauvoo. And when she starts to tell the story about her marriage to Henry Bailey Jacobs, she starts to describe it as an unhappy marriage, which just doesn't jive, in my way of reading the sources, with the contemporary accounts of her life with Henry, which was described as being tender and loving. But as an older woman, when she is a part of the administration, when she's a part of the inner core of leaders of the church, it becomes an act of self-justification, in my way of looking at it. She's justifying her life and her decisions at that point. And she is also towing the party line. And the party line is that those marriages were somehow divinely inspired. And so she tells the story differently from the way she told it when she described it at the time. I think that this presents some really interesting and intriguing questions about the use of source material. If you depend only on the later accounts, you're going to tell the story of Zina's life very differently than if you probe the contemporary accounts of the same thing. And I think an even more interesting process is to look at them all along the way and to watch the process through which Zina becomes very much an insider and changes her point of view to the point where it ends up. One of the things that I've done in my years at BYU as a teacher of historical research technology is challenge my fledgling historians to always, no matter whatever else they have out in front of them, to pursue truth. And I know that it is a very nebulous sort of thing, but if they have a commitment in their hearts and in their minds to always search for truth, then I think that this is probably the most important standard that we as historians can hold up before us. I love this quote by Hubie Brown, where he says, "I should like to see everyone prepared to defend the religion of his or her parents, not because it was the religion of our fathers and mothers, but because they have found it to be the true religion. If one approaches it with an open mind, with a desire to know the truth, and if one questions with a sincere heart what one hears from time to time, he or she will be on the road to growth and service." Hubie Brown challenged us to be brave enough to walk down the path towards truth and then to accept the consequences. And this is the thing I like to tell my students, that we need to have the courage to confront the truth in the face and then do with it what we will, but we must always have that in front of us. I'd like to make some just general observations about the complicated nature of pursuing truth. And I thought in thinking about this in preparation for today, about the whole issue of truth and relationships. And so I'm going to not just talk about the issue of truth in history, but truth in relationships in terms of our conduct in the world outside of the church and inside the church both. These ideas seem to be applicable to our general experience, not just to those of us who are historians. First of all, it seems that there are some truths that are more important or more relevant than others. And perhaps in writing the script of Legacy, the men and women who put together that story believed that this one story was more important than that little piece of truth about her ceiling to Joseph Smith, and they created a hierarchy that put that so far down at the bottom that it couldn't be squeezed in. But I think that we all would be in agreement that there are some truths that are more important and that there is sort of a natural hierarchy of truths. In my example of my father had a hierarchy of truth, and truth was right up there at the top for him. It didn't really matter what else we had done. Telling the truth was the absolute most important to him. The truth of a fact varies in intensity or degree and is relative to time, place, perspective, circumstance, belief, associated truths, culture, among many other factors. In short, truth is relevant only in the historical context that it plays out in. And we need to understand, we need to investigate the historical context of an event, of a person's attitude or a situation to understand it. Third, in an effort to achieve a greater good or truth, lesser truths may be subordinated or sacrificed for the presentation of a higher truth. And again, the example of Legacy, I think, works here. That maybe because of the important missionary impact of the messages of these stories that were portrayed, these lesser truths, in their opinion, could be subordinated. I think some truth is lie and some lie truth. We might believe that we are telling the truth when we are actually living deluded lives, where we are fooling ourselves. Truth and its use is tempered by values. I think we would all believe that. We cannot escape the fact that we look at the world through these Mormon attitudes, through Mormon eyes, with this culture and this tradition that colors our estimation of what is true. I wonder how many times when we talk about truth, we color that estimation also with what we think ought to be true, or what we wish would be true, or what might be true someday. At any given moment, several truths coexist simultaneously, and in fact might even compete with each other. Truths have utilitarian properties. Some are more useful and helpful than others. Truth-telling is not always inherently virtuous or the highest good, and again, I think that depends on the context. I would disagree with my father on that. Truth is often subjective and varies with the eyes of the beholder. Any one truth is relative to all considerations in the context, and I think we could use the slogan from real estate, context, context, context. People oftentimes confuse truth with belief and opinion. Just because a huge number of people believe something is true doesn't mean that it is necessarily true. It can be an opinion of a certain particular group, a reflection of their mindset. It is not necessarily valid or fair for one person to judge the truth-telling of another. And I say this as an exhortation to myself to not be too harsh with Zina, that perhaps in her 80s that became a true story to her. And again, it's the context that it plays out in. No people share exactly the same knowledge, understandings, assumptions, values, and goals. What holds true in one situation may be untrue or not as true, or true with a different meaning in another. Giving a truthful yes or no to a question may not produce an entirely truthful communication. In a complex situation, one isolated truth will not adequately be the overall truth. There are many kinds of truth: scientific truth, religious truth, psychological, emotional, statistical, spiritual, political, and each type varies in degree, quality, reliability, and usability in terms of writing history. This is a quote from John Sparrow, who was an English legal scholar. Every lawyer knows that a witness, while wrong on a number of points, may yet be right on others, perhaps including the essential one. Every lawyer knows that honest and truthful witnesses may contradict themselves, particularly on questions concerning their own and others' motives and states of mind, without thereby forfeiting credibility. Finally, every lawyer knows that in a big and complicated case, there is always at the end of it a residue of improbable, inexplicable fact. You do not invalidate a hypothesis by showing that the chances were against the occurrence of some of the events that it presupposes. Many things that happen are actually improbable and unlikely, but they did happen. There may be far more relative or conditional truths than absolute truths. Truths vary in their verifiability. Some can be proven and others just simply cannot. Truth issues may not be entirely in the domain of the conscience. We may in part be directed by subconscious truth and value systems. There are specific truths and general truths, or individual, seemingly separate truths, and collective conglomerate truth, which may include errors or dissenting truth. For example, the people elected a new president, and this sounds so familiar, I think you'll think back last November. Although with three candidates, nearly 60% voted against him, so the statement is only true of 40% of the people. So only 40% of the people actually elected a new president. 60% of them were against him. I think there are three last things. In the context of one of the really interesting themes in our church's history is the whole idea of lying for the Lord. If there are different kinds of truth in interaction, misunderstandings will arise of incompatible truth assumptions, which are imposed on other kinds of truth to which they don't apply. A lie may be more virtuous than telling the truth, and again, it's in the context of the historical time period that it played out. Sarai lied and said Abraham was her brother, thereby saving her life, his life. A falsehood brought a greater good that far outweighed the good of telling the truth to evildoers. As in the above story, not everyone has a right to the truth, nor is everyone always obligated morally to tell the truth. So, where does this leave us as historians? What are we to do? Usually it seems that the only way to decide between two or more possibilities is to bring to bear a wide and detailed knowledge of the historical situation, such as abstractions, an understanding of the context that statistics alone cannot give you. The historian's common sense is not common opinion, a set of clichés and platitudes. It is the exercise of consistent and explicit reasoning. One of its dictates is that when a straightforward, sufficient explanation occurs on the surface of events, it is to be preferred to any speculative ones in the depths. The historian arrives at truth through probability, not a doubtful kind of truth, but a firm reliance on the likelihood that evidence which has been examined and found solid is veracious. The number of signs that point to genuineness reinforce one another and vastly increase the total probability. Their force can be measured, it can be weighed back and forth, and some sort of end result can come forward. Now, I think this is the fun part. I've always thought that one of the reasons I'm a historian is because I have this sort of voyeur in me, and that I would really be happy just sitting on a stool outside someone's window watching the way that they live. And so I get to do this to people a long, long time ago. And one of the things that we do is weigh the evidence in this effort to find some sort of accurate representation of what life was really like. And so I thought I would talk for a few minutes about uses of evidence. I think we could, in the tradition of the past, do what I call source mining, which is the practice of looking and looking and looking for favorable evidence without at the same time looking for contrary evidence. One of the very hardest things of all to do is when you start out with a certain hypothesis, which I think is really dangerous. But when you do that, you're looking for things that are going to support that idea you've got in your mind. I think the better thing to do is to look at the sources and then to determine your conclusion or your thesis from the evidence in front of you, rather than trying to source mine. Those of us who are professionally trained feel an obligation to do this, to strive for balance, to lose as much as we can of our bias, our clouded vision, to let the sources speak. I don't think that there are any hard and safe rules of evidence in writing history, although I remember in the film All the President's Men, when they were talking about evidence, they said, we never go with a story unless we have three sources. And I think it's a really good basic rule of thumb. I want you to think about the different kinds of sources that history is based upon. There's a huge difference between a newspaper account of an event and an oral history of an event and a diary account of an event. And each one of those sources has different drawbacks, different problems in dealing with it, and some of them offer information that you can't get in any other type of way. So we need to consider the question first of what types of evidence are available. Do they come from a variety of points of view? A number of years ago, I was teaching a class at the BYU Salt Lake, which is on 39th South, and out the window, as I was teaching American Heritage, there was a head-on collision, you know, and I saw it. I was watching. I was kind of I was teaching, but I was also sort of daydreaming, and so I was looking out the window, and I saw these two cars collide. And so my class and I, we all ran out onto the street, and of course the police came and they wanted witnesses. Well, I was a witness. I'd been watching it. A woman across the street had been witnessing it, and a person on the street was a witness to the event. And each one of us had totally different stories. It was as if we had witnessed three different events. And when I saw it written up in the newspaper the very next day, it was like they weren't even talking about the accident that any three of us had witnessed. So each one of those sources told the story from a totally different point of view. Now, when we have these kinds of sources before us, the next question we need to ask is this object or is this source genuine? Is it true? Well, my telling of the story was as true as I could tell it because I just laid it out the way I saw it. The person on the street that was carrying a baby and that was reaching down to pick up a bottle that she had dropped when the accident occurred told her story with a little bit different twist. And she might not have been watching as carefully. It might not have been as genuine an account of the story. The newspaper reporter, who knows what motivation newspaper reporters have when they're telling their stories. There's so much of them in the story as they tell the account that you need to learn about the newspaper itself. What is the political viewpoint of that newspaper? Why do they tell stories the way they tell them? What is the political bent of the reporter? Does this newspaper have an agenda? I think one of the things that's been so stunning, and I've thought about this all summer long because my name's been in the paper again and again and again, you know, and so I'm reading the newspaper differently because I know how twisted our quotes can be once they're taken out of the context of a conversation. It's made me realize that, and this is something I've said to people again and again and again as we've talked about these issues that have been in the air this summer, just because it's in print doesn't mean it's true. All it means is that's the story that the news writer wrote. Is the message trustworthy? Is it a true representation, or is it so totally biased? And this is one of the things we have in dealing with the whole period of Nauvoo. There are some very prominent anti-Mormon tracts that tell the stories of Zinal's life, for example. In fact, one of my very favorite stories is told by an anti-Mormon who had left the church by the time the saints had gotten to winter quarters. And he said that Brigham Young said to him that he told Henry Bailey that he would go, that his boots were going to be filled by another man. And I love that quote. I've always wished I could use it, but it's told by someone whose intent is so corrupted in terms of the telling of that event. He wanted them to look bad. He wanted the story to be ugly, and so it produces a questionable nature for that document. It's important to look at the length from the creation of the source, and again, these later stories of Zina is a really good example of that. You know, when you're telling about events that happened 60 years ago, the events will be very, very different from if you're telling about them on the spot, or if you're writing in your journal that day, you're going to tell a very different story than this story you're going to tell 60 years down the road. So that's very important as well. How does the statement compare with other statements about the event? Is there enough of it that supports each other? And again, that's why I like that rule of at least three basic sources to verify something. You always need to find out about the credibility of the author and why they would have told the story that particular way. Overall, by way of conclusion, I think the search is very rewarding and certainly worth the care we must give it. I do not believe that we will ever reach truth, but we will create a new truth, which is perhaps as much as anything a story about ourselves. Where we are, what we bring to this story is a new story.
Good afternoon. I believe you'll find my presentation quite a bit more dry than that intensely interesting presentation. Despite her self-confessed limitations, Marty, you think very much like a lawyer and have a grasp of what the issues really are. As a predicate to the presentation of my fellow panelist, Michael Homer, concerning the use of affidavits in historical scholarship, I would like to discuss with you the legal standards concerning the use and admission of evidence, and particularly affidavits in a court of law. As Mike will discuss at more length, the legal rules for evaluating evidence, which actually developed during the Renaissance, and which in modified form are applied in many legal systems today, were adopted by historians of the same period who were attempting to find a methodology for evaluating historical evidence. Historians should not find some level of application of legal rules of evidence to their work either disconcerting or obstructive, rather, I think for a couple of reasons. First, both historians and lawyers want their evidence and the foundation of their work to have one prominent characteristic, if not others, and that's reliability. Reliability. That's the key word and the touchstone. Second, both court trials and historical scholarship have one thing in common, and that is that both are presentation of past events. Accordingly, reliability, thoroughness, and accuracy are of paramount concern in both. Let me say, before I get too much further, that I lay no claim to being a historian, particularly a historian of Mormon history, and recognizing my limitations, I will leave the specific application of that science to my very able co-presenters, Marty and Mike Homer. Nonetheless, I think that the rules and constraints and disciplines that I must work under every day as a trial lawyer could have substantial application to other endeavors or scholarly endeavors particularly. Let's talk about some definitions. According to Professor McCormick's leading treatise on the law of evidence, he says, quote, "The law of evidence is the system of rules and standards by which the admission of proof at trial of a lawsuit is regulated," close quote. Unfortunately, the public perception of the legal rules of evidence is that they are cumbersome and overly technical and often render the result of the trial to be determined by technicalities rather than a complete overview of the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. While this impression may be somewhat justified, we must keep in mind that the goal of the rules of evidence is to make certain that judges and juries who have to make the decision hear only reliable, relevant evidence. As Marty alluded to, it is basic human nature, particularly as I observe it in the law, that if one is trying to prove a particular point or believes strongly in a particular idea or is under attack in an adversarial setting, a person may, consciously or unconsciously, resort to exaggerations, perjury, half-truths, creation of unreliable evidence, and the other multitude of sins we see in the litigation process. It is these features of human nature which the rules of evidence are designed to protect against. The rules, in essence, provide tests for reliability of evidence which the evidence must pass before it will be deemed admitted into the legal record and to be usable by the trier of fact, be it judges or juries. What I'd like to do now is focus on a type of evidence which is particularly troublesome in the law, if not history, and that is affidavits of witnesses. Affidavits, as I'm sure you know, are simply written statements filed with the court to support or oppose a motion or some other legal proceeding. They have limited use, and they must be either sworn under penalties of perjury or sworn to in the presence of a notary public. Now, one thing that's important that has to be remembered and often is not is that affidavits must comply with the same basic evidentiary requirements as oral testimony given in court. Here's what the relevant rule, Rule 56E of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure provides, that affidavits, quote, shall be made on personal knowledge, shall set forth facts as would be admissible in evidence, and shall show affirmatively that the affiant is competent to testify to the matters stated therein, close quote. Accordingly, and to quote a corollary rule, Rule 602 of the Rules of Evidence, even in an affidavit, quote, a witness may not testify to a matter unless evidence is introduced prior to the testimony to support a finding that the witness has personal knowledge of the matter. Also, there is a body of law that tells us that affidavits should be disregarded by the court when a couple of factors are present. First, the affidavit sets forth opinions or conclusions rather than facts. How many of those have you seen? Or second, where the witness lacks credibility, such as where the witness's previous testimony in a deposition or otherwise contradicts the affidavit. As a corollary to the rules of evidence, we have a rule that provides that scandalous or impertinent matter, even if it's true, may be stricken from any pleading filed in court. We're trying to not make these proceedings like a reading of the National Enquirer, although frequently they are that way. In short, affidavits have got to comply with the evidentiary standards applied to oral testimony given in court, notwithstanding that affidavits are, by their nature, inherently unilateral statements that are not subject to cross-examination. In other words, an affidavit, just because it's an affidavit, can't be based on inadmissible hearsay, lack of personal knowledge, or based upon documents the authenticity of which is in doubt. Now, one of the most fundamental rights, I think, as you know, of a litigant in a court of law is the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses. Affidavits are particularly troublesome in this regard because they are not, of course, subject to cross-examination. They're simply written and filed. Accordingly, they should be accorded, in my view, minimal weight and used by caution, used with caution by jurists and judges or anyone who's must resolve an issue such as an arbitrator. Now, an interesting aspect of affidavits that we run into continually is the issue of unknown or hidden authorship. What do you mean by unknown or hidden authorship? My heavens, they're signed by a witness. Isn't it the witness's statement? Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. There is a temptation in legal practice for lawyers to author an affidavit in a manner that they know supports their case or what they're trying to do, and simply stick it under the witness's nose and say, sign this, it'll work great for us. In other words, what one often sees is the author's view or the lawyer's view of the facts and not necessarily that of the subscribing witness. This is no more apparent than when the affidavit is used in a subsequent oral proceeding, such as a deposition or a hearing, where you show the affidavit to the witness authenticates it as their affidavit, then you start asking questions about specific statements. You would be surprised how often under cross-examination the witness says, well, my lawyer wrote that, or gosh, that really wasn't my words, or somebody told me to say this, or I don't remember that, or did I write that? You'd be surprised how often that happens. And certainly the most embarrassed party in the room is the lawyer, not the witness. Any lawyer with any trial experience will explain to a witness who's signing an affidavit, particularly when it's filed early in a case or at any time, that you better know what you're talking about, and these better be your words, because someday, somewhere, you're going to have to justify everything that's here. Of course, when the affidavit was executed by someone who's deceased, that becomes a more difficult issue. Let me just summarize that experience has shown us as trial lawyers that there's a great deal of abuse concerning the use of affidavits as evidence. And these problems, I think, can be summarized into three categories. First, and as I stated above, affidavits are the product of the proponent of the position being supported by the affidavit rather than strictly the product of the subscribing witness. Now, the witness may be the proponent of that position, but very often affidavits are authored and signed, or are executed, rather, by non-party witnesses. Number two, they are often conclusory, lacking in basic foundation, and riddled with hearsay and unsupported references, which, if you're not subject to cross-examination, is easy to do. Third, and to allude to a remark Marty made earlier, they are sometimes factually selective, depending upon the particular motion being supported, the stage in the case that they're being used for, and so on. Accordingly, the same facts may be stated differently in a later affidavit in the same case but under a different context. And obviously that is fodder for mean, cruel, and heartless cross-examination. Now let me talk about the idea of establishing a foundation, which I think probably has a strong corollary in historical scholarship. And that is one of the most important, if not the most important, predicates to the admission of evidence into the record of a court of law is the establishment of a, quote, foundation. And here's what one of the leading writers on evidence defines that as, quote, "Before you can offer something into evidence, you must lay a proper foundation for its admission. Both the substantive law of evidence and the procedural rules governing evidence require as a condition precedent to the admission of an item into evidence that the item's predicate or foundation must be laid. For example, a writing must be shown to be authentic, that is, to be what it purports to be, before it can be offered into evidence." Close quote. Whether an affiant or witness is testifying based on personal knowledge is a component of what we call foundation. For example, if one is attempting to introduce a particular document into evidence, the proponent must establish through the witness having personal knowledge of the foundational facts the following. And these, I think, you'll find intuitive. One, that the witness observed the preparation or execution of the document. Two, when the witness observed the execution or preparation of the document. Third, where the witness observed it. Fourth, what other persons were present. Fifth, that the document was executed. And sixth, that the witness recognizes the exhibit presented as the document which has been executed. That is, you're talking about the same thing you're looking at. Now, another fundamental rule of evidence I think that will have a corollary in other types of scholarship is what's known as the best evidence rule. Let's say, for example, that the terms of a document are at issue. In that case, you must lay a foundation that the document is the original, or you must show that the requirements of the original document rule, the so-called best evidence rule, have otherwise been satisfied. In the legal context as well as the historical context, the best evidence rule has some interesting aspects to it and some interesting war stories we all run into. Simply stated, the best evidence rule requires that the proof of a fact be provided by the best evidence, not necessarily the only evidence, but the best evidence that is available to prove it, even though other evidence is available. For example, if a witness testifies that she has seen a particular document and attempts to testify about the contents of that document without the document in evidence, an objection based on the best evidence rule will probably be sustained. This is because the best evidence of the contents of the document is the document, not someone's rendition of it. Another example would be where the contents of a document, and we find this frequently, have been paraphrased or excerpted in another document. The paraphrased or excerpted document is not the best evidence of the referred-to document. The referred-to document is. And this is all quite intuitive. However, secondary evidence can be admissible if, for example, the original has been lost and proof has been provided of that, or that there is no other way to do it. It's a hierarchical concept as to what is best as you go through the proof of the particular fact. Oral conversations. We have a lot of fun with this one and the kinds of foundations that need to be laid. Before a witness can testify as to conversations with someone or the contents of a meeting, a witness must testify as follows. One, when the meeting took place. Two, where the meeting took place. Three, who was present. And fourth, what was said and by whom in words or in substance at the meeting. Generally, witnesses are not allowed to simply summarize a meeting or give their impression of it when there is some available memory as to the exact words that were stated in what order. Witnesses in deposition have a very difficult time with this concept as a general rule. let me talk about differing foundational requirements. It depends upon what you're offering evidence for. Let's say, for example, that a witness is asked to talk about a voice that was heard in a telephone conversation. If they are asked, whose voice was it? If that's the ultimate question or the item of proof, then there has to be a predicate laid as to, are they familiar with the voice? How are they familiar with it? Etc. They can't be speculating. They must have heard it before, for example. However, if the witness is simply asked to describe the vocal characteristics, such as a high-pitched voice, a soft voice, etc., that requires much less foundation because it is simply offered to show those initial impression characteristics. So you can see the difference between the level of foundation depending on what you're using it for. Finally, let me address the subject of hearsay. This is one that is difficult for lay people and lawyers alike. And here's one commentator's summary, which I think is a good one, about the concern and the reason behind the hearsay doctrine. The reason behind the hearsay doctrine is a concern about the reliability of certain evidence, in particular, a concern about the reliability of in-court testimony about out-of-court statements. Whenever the proponent of that testimony attempts to use those statements as evidence in the case, under the common law, hearsay was not allowed because the court reasoned that the person who made the statement should be subject to cross-examination, not someone who heard that person make the statement. So once again, it's a concern over the right to cross-examination. In other words, hearsay testimonial evidence is evidence based on "I heard that" or "someone told me that." Hearsay is viewed as particularly unreliable in the law, and the reason for this is because it is very easy for a witness, as we know from court and common conversations with people, wanting to justify a certain point or belief, to say that they heard it from someone else, and of course you don't know that because the someone else isn't there. Very often lawyers encounter what we call hearsay on hearsay, where someone says, "Well, I heard this from someone who heard it from someone." In other words, the classic rumor mill. The rules of evidence have a precise definition for hearsay, which is, quote, "a statement other than one made by the declarant while testifying at the trial or hearing offered in evidence to prove the truth of the matter asserted." Now, to understand the rationale behind the hearsay rule, game we used to play where a group of children would sit in a circle and the first child would whisper a statement in the ear of the second child, and the second child would tell it to the third child, and the third child to the fourth child. And when you got to the very end of the circle, the last child says what it is that they heard, often to the amusement of the group, and particularly to the amusement of the one who started the statement. And maybe that can be applied to the press, I don't know. Yeah. And that game is certainly practiced in our adult lives, unfortunately. Now, there's an important limitation to hearsay, and that is testimony about the out-of-court declaration has to be offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. Now, let me give you an example of that. If a witness testifies that they overheard a statement while they were standing in the lobby of a building, and the purpose of the witness testifying to that was to prove that what the statement was true, and that's relevant evidence to the point, then that's hearsay. If the statement is offered simply to show that the person was in the building, that is, that somebody heard them talking, then that is not hearsay because it's not offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted, if you get that distinction. We struggle with that often as what it's offered for. Now, the law, as you may be aware, has created a number of exceptions to the hearsay rule so that once something is hearsay, there are some exceptions, 24 to be exact, where you can use it. What the law has recognized is that what we human beings know about the world around us and things that happen around us is very often the product of things that have been told to us, either by documents or orally. And you can't totally exclude that, or most trials would come to a screeching halt. The rationale, the legal rationale behind the exceptions to the hearsay rule are that even though certain kinds of hearsay evidence are just that, that there are other sufficient indices of reliability that make them usable and advisable to be used in court in order to get to the truth. Let me give you a couple of examples, a couple of which will be very interesting, I think, to historians. A witness can testify to a statement made to them by someone concerning that person's emotional or physical condition, such as, "I don't feel well today." That kind of evidence, by the way, is very often used in will contests when you're talking about the decedent's competence in terms of were they sick the day they signed the will, did they know what they were doing, did they say, "I'm dizzy," things like that. This should be a particularly interest to historians. There is an exception that provides that statements in a document in existence for 20 years or more, the authenticity of which is established, is admitted as an exception to the hearsay rule. What's magic about 20 years? I don't have any idea. I think perhaps the authors of the code said that if someone's going to lie, they would do it closer to the event. And many of you will know more about that than I do. It's important to note that hearsay can be oral statements as well as things written. For example, if I hear Mike tell me something and I testify to it in court, but what I'm offering on that testimony is a note I wrote down about what he told me, that's still hearsay. And so, as Marty suggested, just because it's in writing or in print, you don't have to believe it. Another couple of exceptions will be of interest to historians are that there is an exception to the hearsay rule for records of religious organizations. However, limited to statements of births, marriages, divorces, deaths, legitimacy, ancestry, relationship by blood or marriage, or other similar facts of personal family history contained in a regularly kept record of a religious organization. And, of course, the LDS Church seems to do that better than most denominations. Also, interestingly enough, family records, which they say are statements of fact concerning personal or family history contained in family Bibles, genealogies, charts, engravings on rings, inscriptions on family portraits, engravings on urns, crypts, or tombstones. Figure that one out. And let me close by talking about the so-called personal knowledge requirement. As I noted above, you have to testify from personal knowledge. That's one of the most important components. People have a tendency to talk about things they don't know anything about. Not that I ever do that, of course. Let me give you an example to follow up on Marty's analogy to an auto accident, or a story about an auto accident. You can very often find an affidavit that has a flat statement of fact, such as, at 1:30 p.m. on August 9th at the intersection of Elm Street and Maple Street, John Doe ran the red light. Now, you would see that in an affidavit and you say to yourself, well, geez, that person must have been there. But folks, very often you will get that person under cross-examination and you'll say to them, how do you know that? Well, my mother told me, and I always believe my mother. Were you there? No. Okay. No personal knowledge. And that's the weakness in affidavits, is that very often they contain these flat assertions of fact. Obviously, someone who was there is a better witness than someone who wasn't. However, in the law, the vastly different perceptions that eyewitnesses can have to the same event is a very puzzling aspect of human psychology, which is, I'm sure, far beyond the scope of this discussion. Finally, in the rules of evidence, testimony by affidavits or otherwise cannot be conclusory. Very often, that is human nature to simply come to a conclusion rather than to state the facts that lead to the conclusion. If, for example, an affiant says, John Doe is a drunk, okay, that's a conclusion. Those are not facts leading to the conclusion. However, if they testify that I'm in XYZ bar every night and I sit next to John and John has at least 16 drinks, then those are the facts that would lead someone to the conclusion that John Doe is a drunk, but that is the province of the judge or the jury. The rules of evidence are, to be sure, complicated, technical, and riddled with exceptions and variations. However, the goal we have as lawyers and I think historians is reliability. Thank you.
It is probably painful for some historians to acknowledge that their profession has important historical connections with the law. Who would want anything to do with what many perceive as being paid to, quote, read the warranty on your toaster oven, close quote, and according to a new National Law Journal survey, is held in about as much esteem as journalists and elected officials. I'm not sure if we have either of those two out in the audience today. Church historians may be criticized by general authorities, but lawyers are criticized by nearly everyone, including historians, and believe it or not, by lawyers themselves. I think it's the one of the more famous quotes there is Clarence Darrow, who said, "The trouble with law is lawyers." I have often heard historians complain that lawyers make poor historians because they come from an adversarial setting which encourages them to cast facts in the light most favorable to their clients, which results in the telling of half-truths or lies to prevail at trial. It was Judge Irving Kaufman who said, "The trial lawyer does what Socrates was executed for, making the worst argument appear the stronger." But despite whatever pain it may cause, lawyers and professional historians share many of the same tools. Those familiar with Mormon history know that both apologists and opponents often resort to legalistic arguments to prove or disprove the claims of the church. Like lawyers, these writers have a case to make and accentuate the facts which support it, and either de-emphasize or ignore facts which do not. Convinced by knowledge that others have ignored or failed to appreciate, they are defenders of the faith or offenders for a word, and are convinced that facts will eventually confirm or deny all of the essential claims of the church. While lawyers are prevented by judges from introducing evidence of dubious relevance or probative value, historians and pseudo-historians are limited by their professional ethics, common sense, publishers, and in some cases, what is politically or religiously correct. Conclusions are often made which seem justified by the evidence, which is in most cases buried in the footnotes, with little discussion concerning the strengths and weaknesses of the evidence on which the conclusions rely or depend. This type of legalistic debate in Mormon history has been taking place for almost 160 years. The prototype is E.D. Howe's book, Mormonism Unveiled, published in 1834, which even the author, or actually publisher, Howe, recognized that many anti-Mormon books and articles since that time have copied as a prototype for both substance and approach. Mormonism Unveiled is essentially a legal brief authored to marshal evidence to prove that the claims of Joseph Smith, his family, and the 11 witnesses to the Book of Mormon were false. Howe was a publisher in Ohio who was furious when his wife and daughter joined the church. He bought, and there is some evidence that he actually swindled, a manuscript and affidavits from Philastus Hurlbut, an excommunicated Mormon who had threatened the life of Joseph Smith and had been successfully prosecuted by the prophet. Although neither Howe nor Hurlbut were lawyers, Chauncey Hurlbut may have actually helped Philastus write the manuscript. Legal terminology and arguments are utilized throughout the book. In the advertisement, it is noted that the book is a joint effort with, quote, a great number of friends, and that the truth and the whole truth have been his constant aim, and that, quote, sufficient and more than sufficient evidence has been developed by unimpeachable testimony to satisfy every rational person that the Supreme Being had had little agency in the prosperity of Mormonism. In his introduction, the author likewise utilizes lawyer-like language. Those caught up in religion and are frequently guilty of, quote, a callous insensibility to evidence, and, quote, belief is very far from being regulated by the weight of testimony. He then describes the Book of Mormon and the early participants in Mormon history in similar terms. He asserts that, quote, Martin Harris is generally believed by intelligent people to be laboring under a partial derangement, and that any respectful jury would receive his testimony in case of ever so trifling a nature we do not believe. While describing the contents of the Book of Mormon, the author writes, quote, Nephi next takes the stand and testifies roundly to the truths which Joseph, his brother, had been preaching. He also makes reference to, quote, propounding interrogatories to the reader, and, quote, enough has been said to place this matter beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Book of Mormon is a fabrication. And finally, he writes, the testimony of the three witnesses, quote, are not competent testimony. Following a summary of the contents of the Book of Mormon, the author quotes the testimony of the three witnesses and discusses for five pages the common law rules regarding oaths, including that some oath makers may perjure themselves, that some witnesses, quote, do not entertain a just sense of the obligation of an oath and disbelief in a God and a future state of accountability, that a person cannot be a witness, quote, who is interested in the event of a suit, and that an individual who swears must specify the time, place, and circumstances of the event he describes. Obviously, the author was very aware of some of the common law rules of evidence. Without such information, the author notes that, quote, others might be prejudiced by not giving them an opportunity to rebut. He then concludes that the testimony of the three witnesses, Martin Harris, Oliver Cowdery, and David Whitmer, are deficient in all or some of these common law rules. He also finds that the testimony of the eight witnesses is also deficient, largely because the eight consisted of, quote, four Whitmers of the same family and three Smiths, the father and two brothers of the prophet. Just as a sideline, I might note that at least Mark Twain was a little more clever, at least 40 years later, when he made the same criticism. He said, "And when I am far on the road to conviction, and eight men, be they grammatical or otherwise, come forward and tell me that they have seen the plates too, and not only seen those plates but hefted them, I am convinced I would not feel more satisfied and at rest if the entire Whitmer family had testified." The factual predicate for the conclusion upon which the fact for these conclusions drawn by the author of Mormonism Unveiled is contained in 22 affidavits signed by persons who had known Joseph Smith's senior family while residing in Palmyra, New York. Despite his previous discourse on the common law rules governing evidence and the deficiencies of the statements made by witnesses to the Book of Mormon, these affidavits, from a legal evidentiary perspective, have numerous problems. One, none of the affidavits are in their original form, with signatures of the affidavit and the judge or other official before whom an oath was made. And, of course, this is perfectly acceptable if the reader is directed to the location where the original affidavits are kept. No such reference is made in Mormonism Unveiled. Although, in fairness, it may be stated that I believe the historical record will support that the affidavits were in circulation in Kirtland before the publication of the book. Two, only eight of the affidavits are subscribed and sworn before a justice of the peace. In order for an affidavit to be considered authentic, it is necessary for the affiant to appear before an official to take an oath that he made the statement, that it was signed by him, and that it is true. Three, most of the affidavits contain conclusory statements. Willard Chase described the Smith family as a pest to society, Joseph Smith Jr. as a man whose word could not be depended upon. Parley Chase described the Smiths as, quote, lazy, intemperate, and worthless men very much addicted to lying. David Stafford described Joseph Smith Sr. as a, quote, drunkard and a liar, and to be much in the habit of gambling. Barton Stafford also described Joseph Smith Sr. as a noted drunkard. Roswell Nichols said he was a liar and a money digger. Well, even when facts rather than conclusions are given by the various affiants, the testimony is often based on hearsay statements made to the affiant or to someone that the affiant had spoken to after the statement was made, which in legal jargon is referred to as hearsay upon hearsay or double hearsay. For instance, Willard Chase describes a discussion he had with Joseph Smith Sr., in which Joseph Smith Sr. told Chase how Joseph Smith Jr. had found the golden plates, which included the famous toad, which later became an even more famous salamander. Chase also describes stories told to him by Samuel T. Lawrence and Josiah Stoll regarding Joseph Smith's actions. Abigail Harris's affidavit concerning Martin Harris is based on conversations she had with Lucy Mack Smith and Mrs. Martin Harris. Even those witnesses whose testimony is based on actual experiences with the Smith family, including Peter Ingersoll, William Stratford, Willard Chase, and Isaac Hale, contain numerous hearsay statements which are not contemporaneous, but recollection of events which occurred as much as 10 years previous to giving their affidavits. The fact that they are not contemporaneous is important for several reasons. First, it is likely that Hurlbut assembled the various affiants together to discuss their recollections concerning the Smith family, and that he thereafter wrote the affidavits after such group discussions for signature by the various affiants. It is known, for example, that in Manchester, Hurlbut took the statements in the local schoolhouse rather than in the homes of the affiants themselves. Since the originals are not available to analyze, it is impossible to know who wrote the affidavits, but it was and continues to be a common practice, as Jeff pointed out, among lawyers to discuss a matter with his client, to draft an affidavit which reflects those discussions, and to present the affidavit to the client for review and signature. Based on the tenor of the book, it is clear that Hurlbut considered the affiants his clients and witnesses in the case in his case against Mormonism. If this process was followed, some of the recollections set forth in the affidavits may have initially been group recollections, which were then validated or remembered by various members in the group. This would explain many of the similarities in language and recollection in the various affidavits. Now, Richard Lloyd Anderson makes much of the fact that Hurlbut probably wrote the affidavits and gives this as one of the primary reasons for rejecting them because of Hurlbut's obvious bias and his mission to impeach the testimony of Joseph Smith. In my opinion, this is not the real issue. It is perfectly acceptable for a lawyer to write affidavits after discussing a matter with his client. Whether the affidavits reflects the opinion of the affiant is only determinable by cross-examining the witness. It is likely, in my opinion, that all of the affiants signed the affidavits with full knowledge of their contents. That, however, does not shading or lying or repeating stories that they had since adopted as their own. The real issue is whether the affiant had really seen or heard the events described, whether he could have provided more details if called upon to do in a legal setting, i.e. time, place, other persons present, the issues that Jeff noted, and whether there is corroborating evidence to support their testimony. That, however, does not mean they were not exaggerating, shading, or lying. Now, Fawn Brody recognized the likelihood that Hurlbut had written the affidavits, that he, quote, did a little judicious prompting, and that the affidavits, quote, may have been colored by his bias, but gives them some credibility, at least those relating to the money digging, because they were corroborated and supported by court records and the Dogberry editorials. On the other hand, she doubts that the affidavits Hurlbut collected to support his Spalding theory have any credibility at all because there is no corroborating evidence to support that theory. A more recent writer on the subject, Roger Anderson, not related to Richard Lloyd as the subject matter of this book makes obvious, believes that the Hurlbut affidavits are largely immune from attack, that there is no evidence that Hurlbut contaminated the thoughts of the affidavits, that there is no evidence that the affiants repeated groundless rumors, and that the affidavits accurately reflect the beliefs of the signers. He then concludes that, quote, the affidavits must have permanent status as primary documents concerning the life of Joseph Smith. While Richard Lloyd Anderson believes the affidavits are totally unreliable, Roger Anderson believes they are totally reliable. In this Anderson versus Anderson discussion, they are like two parties in a domestic dispute at opposite ends of the spectrum, apparently guided by individual belief. Even if Roger Anderson states at the beginning of his book that his task was not to determine if the conclusions made by the affiants were justified, he ends his book by making many of the same conclusions. A much more cautious approach is contained in D. Michael Quinn's book, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, wherein Dr. Quinn discusses the affidavits, primarily the statements concerning money digging, discusses in some detail the potential problems associated with their reliability, and only concludes that some portions of the affidavits are reliable after citing and discussing other evidence which supports some of the statements made by the affiants. Of course, Mormonism Unveiled had a much more ambitious goal than to simply prove that Joseph Smith was a money digger. Hurlbut stated that the purpose of the affidavits was to establish that, quote, no credit can be given to any one member of the Smith family, and further, quote, according to the common law rules of weighing evidence, the 11 witnesses stand impeached before the public, and until rebutting evidence can be produced, which shall go to invalidate the respectable host which are here offered, we claim that no credit can or ought to be given to the witnesses of the Book of Mormon. Although the affidavits do provide some evidence, that the Smith family was involved in money digging, something that Joseph Smith Jr. Admitted in his famous answer to sundry questions in 1838, wherein he responded to the question, quote, was not Joseph Smith a money digger? As follows, quote, yes, but it was never a very profitable job for him, as he only got $14 a month for it. Nevertheless, there is also some support, that the Smith family enjoyed drinking, fighting, gambling, and talking, that Martin Harris had a volatile temper and battered his wife, that various members of the Smith family may have promised to show the plates to persons in the neighborhood, but later informed them that they had been commanded not to do so, and that several of the affiants may have paid traveling expenses to Joseph Smith for which they were never reimbursed. These facts, even when accepted at face value, do not support Hurlbut's conclusion that Joseph Smith and his family, as well as the 11 witnesses of the Book of Mormon, were lying when they described the gold plates. In fact, after reading the affidavits, one gets the impression that the most credible witnesses, some of whom were themselves money diggers, were more upset by the fact that they had never been allowed to see the plates themselves. Even Brigham Young was prepared to accept the worst and apparently not lose any sleep over it when he stated after their arrival in Utah, quote, he, Joseph Smith, may get drunk every day of his life, sleep with his neighbor's wife every night, run horses and gamble, but the doctrine he has produced will save you and me and the whole world. Perhaps the only two facts, both based on hearsay statements, which provide some support for Hurlbut's universal conclusion, are Peter Ingersoll's statement that Joseph Smith admitted to him that he bundled up white sand and deceived the Smith family into believing it was gold plates, and Ingersoll's statement that Joseph Smith told Isaac Hale that he could not see in the seer stone now and never could, and that his former pretensions in that respect were all false, and that he would give up his old habits of money digging. The problem is there is no corroborating evidence to support these statements. Hale's affidavit mentioned only that Joseph Smith told him that he had given up what he called glass-looking and that he expected to work hard for a living and was willing to do so. After all, he was trying to get permission to marry Emma. He did not mention that Joseph told him that he had never been able to see in a seer stone. As such, Ingersoll is the only witness who claims that Joseph Smith openly admitted to him that his claims were fraudulent. One may ask, why Ingersoll? Particularly in light of Ingersoll's statement that Joseph Smith claimed that he did not admit his deceit to the members of his own family. One would have liked the opportunity to ask Ingersoll what other statements Joseph made to him. Whatever one may think of Joseph Smith, it is hard to imagine that he would have told Ingersoll that he had deceived his own family and that he had committed fraud on the neighborhood. He did admit in 1834, after the publication of the affidavits, that he committed the foibles of youth, but denied any activities which would, quote, constitute gross and outrageous violation of peace and good order for the community. This is a good example of why statements such as Ingersoll's constitute hearsay, are not recognized as competent evidence in American jurisprudence, and should be looked upon very skeptically by historians because of their potential unreliability and bias in the absence of some corroborating evidence. Rather than ending his book with his claim that he had successfully impeached the witnesses to the Book of Mormon, Hurlbut went on to identify, quote, the real and original author or authors of the Book of Mormon. To accomplish this, he produced 7 additional affidavits and 1 additional statement that was not signed. All of these witnesses say essentially the same things. One, they all knew Solomon Spaulding, who died 18 years before the publication of the book. 2, Solomon Spaulding wrote a book called Manuscript Found during the last decade of his life. 3, the book showed that the American Indians were the descendants of the Jews. 4, Solomon Spaulding read portions of his book to the affiants, and the affiants recalled various phrases and names from the book, including Nephi, Lehi, Moroni, Mormon, Zarahemla, as well as the famous And It Came to Pass. Each of the affidavits had subsequently read the Book of Mormon and recognized the passages which Spaulding had read to them during their lifetime some 20 to 22 years earlier. Following the presentation of these witnesses, the author concluded, quote, we are willing to rest the question in the hands of any intelligent jury With the certainty, their verdict would be that Solomon Spaulding first wrote the leading incidents of the Book of Mormon. Following this conclusion, Hurlbut then began to speculate, based upon a further consultation with Solomon Spaulding's widow, although he was unable to obtain, at least at that time, an affidavit from the widow, who had told him that Solomon Spaulding had written a great variety of manuscripts, that she recalled the name manuscript found, but had no recollection of its contents, that she believed it was taken to a printing office in Pittsburgh, that she was unaware whether it had ever been returned from the printers, but that if it had been returned, it would be located in a trunk she had left in New York. Well, after this conversation, Hurlbut traveled to New York, found one manuscript, but concluded that it had no resemblance to the Book of Mormon. He claimed that he showed this manuscript to the various affiants, something that was not mentioned in their affidavits, who confirmed that it was not the manuscript read to them by Solomon Spaulding. Based upon this evidence, he argues, again with no affidavits, that Sidney Rigdon must have come into possession of the manuscript described in the original affidavits, since he was frequently on the premises of the publisher without the benefit of affidavit, that Rigdon wrote the Book of Mormon with the benefit of manuscript found, that he gave the manuscript of the Book of Mormon to Joseph Smith, and that he surreptitiously converted to the church without admitting that he had known Joseph Smith for several years. Perhaps the only reason that the Spaulding theory has survived as long as it has is because of the seven affidavits contained in Hurlbut's book. The fact that seven persons, all presumably honest, remembered with such detail the names read to them by Solomon Spaulding is some evidence that memories of events which occurred long ago, with intervening events such as the publication of the Book of Mormon, should be taken only with great skepticism. Now, none of this is to suggest that the Hurlbut affidavits are totally worthless and without any value to historians. After all, unless one finds a particularly talented medium, it is impossible to cross-examine dead people. However, given that problem, historians and others who dabble in Mormon history should be extremely cautious, more cautious than Howe or Hurlbut and others have been in drawing grand conclusions from them. Thank you. Looks like we have about 10 minutes. If anyone has any questions of any of the presenters, you're welcome to do that, or if you'd prefer to just do that privately, that's perfectly acceptable as well. Yes, sir.
One comment is that I've been told that Latin has no definitive article, and I was thinking we would be better off if English didn't. I kept hearing the word truth, and I could almost hear the implication that there was a "the" in front of it, and I think that most truth is relative. The other comment I wanted to make was on legacy. The episodes in this magnificent film are a compilation from more than one diary. In fact, my brother-in-law's ancestor was one of the major contributors of episodes. And this film, which was an hour and a half to begin with, has been cut to 51 minutes. And there is enough drama in the history of the Mormon Church to take one incident and give it for 4 or 5 hours. I was a little taken aback by the remark about whether it was true or not. If I say that Marty is an attractive woman, the fact that she may be wearing a prosthesis is irrelevant and doesn't change the truth of my statement.
Any follow-up on that question? Yes, sir.
Did you have
a follow-up? Well, if I had more time to discuss the whole issue of why we seem to be involved in these legalistic arguments about whether the church is, quote, true or not true, I think that it was started by the Mormons, by, you know, adding those types of documents to the book. And it's just gone from there. I think that that type of document should be subjected to exactly the same type of analysis that I discussed with respect to the Hurlbut affidavits. My own personal opinion is that these types of issues are not provable anyway, that religion is a matter of faith, and that it's, even though it's a fun process and we can learn a lot of things, and I enjoy doing it as you do, ultimately the type of task that Howe/Hurlbut put themselves to as impossible, that you can't prove or disprove. It's simply a matter of faith. And so, but I think from an academic perspective, it should be subjected to exactly the same type of analysis with all of the evidence that you cite.
Thank you for coming.